it's John Dennis on Thursday the 17th of September. Today, The Guardian reveals how an oil firm tried to cover up the dumping of toxic waste. Trafigura has now offered cash to 31,000 African victims.
When they realised that their legal attempts were failing, suddenly they made public that they were going to have a settlement.
And in other news today, thousands of schools are already considering making redundancies and increasing class sizes to reduce costs, and that's before the looming cuts in public spending.
There are about 2,000 schools across the country that are currently projecting a deficit by the end of this year.
And there are fears that China may not cut emissions by as much as the West hopes. First, the news headlines with Bill Overton.
France is to clear squatter camps of illegal migrants around the port of Calais. The immigration minister, Eric Besson, says they'll be cleared within a week. The migrants, mostly Afghans or Iraqis, gather around the port trying to find ways of smuggling themselves into Britain. The town authorities believe there are as many as 1,500 living there in makeshift tents. Many have been brought by people traffickers. The Attorney General, Baroness Scotland, sacked her cleaner after finding out she was living in Britain illegally. The Daily Mail reported the 27-year-old woman from the South Pacific island of Tonga had illegally stayed on after her student visa expired. A spokesman said the government's most senior law officer had not knowingly employed an illegal immigrant, but she has now been dismissed. Postal workers are being balloted on whether they want to go on strike. Ballot papers are being sent out to 120,000 staff today after a series of one-day strikes around the country. The union says they want to be properly consulted about modernisation and job cuts. Royal Mail say the union is reneging on an agreement made 2 years ago. The Institute of Fiscal Studies claims Britain's about to go through the tightest squeeze on public spending since the 1970s. It says the increases in public spending by the Labour government could be completely wiped out unless there's an increase in taxes. And Mary Travers of the 60s folk group Peter, Paul and Mary has died from cancer at the age of 72. The group was known for their hit Puff the Magic Dragon and the Bob Dylan song Blowing in the Wind. Our paper's joined by The Independent this morning in putting the story about a British oil trading firm on its front page. Both papers reporting thousands of West Africans will be paid compensation for illness after the company Trafigura organised the dumping of toxic waste. The Telegraph and The Times lead with the announcement by the Health Secretary Andy Burnham, patients to pick GP anywhere they like. That's the Times headline. The minister wants to end the restricted catchment area for GPs and let patients from any area choose any GP they like. He says commuters may prefer to be registered near their work, for instance. The Financial Times and The Telegraph both put the government spending cuts on their front pages. The information based on Treasury papers leaked to the Conservative leader David Cameron. The FT says Cameron's accusing Gordon Brown of a cover-up of what he plans in cuts, which could be as much as 10%. The Daily Mail leads with its exclusive about the Attorney General sacking her cleaner, and several sports pages tell the tale of the boss of Formula One team Renault resigning over the admission he ordered driver Nelson Piquet Jr. to deliberately crash his car. Our paper's motoring correspondent Alan Henry believes Renault may now close down its team altogether. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The British oil company Trafigura has offered to pay compensation to 31,000 people poisoned by toxic waste. The firm chartered a ship called Probo Koala, which transported the deadly cargo to Ivory Coast in 2006. 400 tonnes of chemical waste was tipped onto local dumps in the country's capital, Abidjan. A series of internal emails has now come to light that shows how company bosses tried to cover up what happened. This was Britain's biggest ever group lawsuit and one of the world's biggest cases of mass poisoning through environmental pollution. David Lee is our investigations editor.
It's a big surprise that they have suddenly announced that they have a compensation deal and are willing to pay out. They've spent the last 3 years fighting this deal tooth and nail and saying they wouldn't pay anybody and their claims to be injured were all imaginary. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that they've been running around the law courts, not only here, but in Norway and in the Netherlands as well, trying to gag journalists who found out about these emails and wanted to publish them. When they realised that their legal attempts were failing, suddenly they made public that they were going to have a settlement.
What's in these emails?
They reveal, in essence, that there's been a very big cover-up. Trafigura told everybody, they told the world, that their waste, which had been dumped in Abidjan in the Ivory Coast, was completely harmless. It wouldn't hurt a fly. It was part of the kind of routine discharge of slops, as they call it, from tankers when they clean out their waste tanks. And there was nothing harmful about it at all. These emails show that they had, in fact, been told by their own managers from well in advance that this stuff was highly toxic. So toxic, in fact, that it's been banned throughout Europe.
And people can read these emails in full on The Guardian's website today. What does Trafigura say about claims of a cover-up?
They deny there's a cover-up. They say that's utterly without foundation, that everything they said at the time was in good faith and that they really did believe that this stuff was harmless. People can read these emails in which we have an insight into them privately talking to each other, and they can make up their own minds.
What does Trafigura say about the presence of hydrogen sulfide in the waste?
Hydrogen sulfide is the killer gas that's really been at the heart of this, because it's appeared that these injuries, and indeed some deaths, might have been caused by hydrogen sulfide escaping from the waste. It's certainly present in the waste. They say, oh, they've got experts. They say it couldn't have escaped from the waste because of complicated chemical reasons, and therefore it's impossible that the hydrogen sulfide, which is in their waste, could have got out in gas form and essentially gassed people. They said that couldn't have happened.
And what do they say about the autopsy reports then that have showed fatal levels of hydrogen sulfide in 12 alleged victims?
Well, they've got an answer for that. They say these reports are unreliable, that the bodies had been putrefied, and maybe the hydrogen sulfide that was discovered came from somewhere else. They've always had an answer to everything until now. They've said all the allegations against them are completely 100% wrong. And then today they suddenly turn around and say, all right, we'll make some payments.
We don't know how much these payments are yet.
No, that's being kept secret, just as other terms of the settlement may well be kept confidential. I'm sure that Trafigura don't want very much more to come out about the details of the whole thing. Unfortunately, from their point of view, this move has come too late to prevent us revealing these dozens of emails that show in startling detail, really, what was going on inside that company.
And has this opened the door now to further legal claims against Trafigura?
Well, Greenpeace in Holland have put in a formal legal action there in the Netherlands calling for Trafigura to be prosecuted for manslaughter or for grievous bodily harm, because they say there's plenty of evidence that what they did indeed kill or seriously injure people. And also in the Netherlands, Trafigura are facing prosecution for allegedly telling lies about their toxic waste when they tried to get it disposed of, got rid of in Amsterdam. And in Norway, the authorities there are investigating an explosion that took place in one of their waste tanks, where prosecutions against the owner of the waste tanks are already taking place. So they're embroiled in plenty of potential prosecutions.
David Lee, well, The Guardian's Zan Rice went to Abidjan last year to meet some of the victims and find out more about what happened.
Well, in August 2006, a ship arrived at a port in Abidjan, a ship chartered by Trafigura, and unloaded this chemical waste. A local company took the waste from the ship and then dumped it at various sites around the city. 16 trucks set out across the night and just fly-tipped 500 tons of waste at various locations, basically wherever they could, industrial areas and suburban areas, next to a prison, in open drains.
And you went to Abidjan last year, Zan, and met some of the victims. What did they say about it?
Well, they described the initial reaction. It was a real time of panic in Abidjan. Nearly 100,000 people sought hospital treatment. They all described similar sensations, a noxious onion smell hovering over the city, particularly in the areas where the waste was dumped, noses running, a burning sensation, headaches, stomach aches. Many of them had to take time off work, some of them quite a lot of time off work. Some actually had to move out of their houses.
And some of the toxic waste still hasn't been cleaned up.
Yeah, that's right. Most of it was moved from the original sites and some of it shipped abroad. But I went to one village where less than a kilometre from the village, there were still huge sacks of waste behind a sort of barbed wire fence and skull and crossbones sign. And villagers were certainly very concerned that it was still there. And quite a few of the victims that I met said they were still feeling effects to this day, runny noses, headaches, and they say when it rains in particular and the soil washes away, they get the same sensations as when the waste was originally dumped. Proving that all these things are directly tied to the waste is difficult, but many people had similar stories.
Zan Rice, and there's more at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also on The Guardian's website today, Patrick Barkham on the disappearance of the Thames from London's tube map. What a scandal. Guardian.co.uk/transport. Jonathan Glancy visits the most beautiful railway station in the world, in Belgium. Guardian.co.uk/architecture. And Tom Service, our classical music critic, visits a Hungarian folk club. Guardian.co.uk/arts. As politicians look for public spending cuts, thousands of schools in England are already short of money, according to data passed to The Guardian. Nearly one in 10 schools can't balance their books. The figures were obtained by the Liberal Democrats under the Freedom of Information Act. With the details is our education editor, Polly Curtis.
It tells us that there are about 2,000 schools across the country that are currently projecting a deficit by the end of this year. Now, those schools will be frantically looking at ways to make cuts to avoid that. So they'll be looking at cutting staff, they'll be looking at increasing class sizes, not ordering those extra books they need, those kind of things. And I think this is surprising to people because we've been in a time of plenty. Schools have had a hell of a lot of money over the last kind of decade. And it's surprising that schools are in deficit even before we see all these public spending cuts that we're predicting and expecting.
Why are they facing this budget shortfall at this stage?
Well, it comes down a lot to the funding mechanism the government's got, which doesn't always do the sensible thing. It's a mechanism that's built up over time, and it's got different layers that reward money for different reasons. So you look at a local authority like Haringey, where a third of the schools are facing a deficit. There's a straightforward problem there in that they receive funding to pay teachers outer London wages, which are less than the inner London wages. They have to pay the inner London wages to get the teachers who'll otherwise go and work in Camden or Islington. So they get £1,000 less than all the other local authorities around them, and they have to spend the same amount. So you can see some individual problems like that. The flip side to the coin is that there are many more schools with surpluses. So this creates a question for the government of, why there's a funding mechanism which means that some schools are sitting on millions of pounds and other schools are laying off teachers.
How vulnerable is the education budget to spending cuts being drawn up now, we assume, by Labour and the Tories?
No one's protecting it. And when you look at the amount of money that's gone into education, there are clearly areas that might offer some savings at a time like this. The things that Labour will be looking at the moment are things like its building programme. Should they be committed at the moment to rebuilding every school in the country? At the moment, they're saying they clearly are, but that's got to be under review. One of the biggest expenditures since they came to power has been this massive expansion of the number of teaching assistants, and that's a huge part of the school's budget. But there's never really been strong evidence that they really improve children's learning, so they might be looking at that. But school by school, it's quite hard to cut budgets without cutting staff. Staff are about 80% of a school's budget, so it's very difficult to make those savings without looking at the staffing.
Would the Conservatives be looking to make cuts in the areas that you've just described?
The Conservatives are saying they would protect frontline services, but they would look at the quangocracy around education, which is massive. There are a lot of quangos. Labour say they're all necessary, and I think some of them will be under review. Certainly in higher education, they're under review, but even by the Labour Party government. The Tories are saying that they will make a lot of the savings back just by cutting organisations like the QCDA, which designs curriculum, various teacher training bodies, leadership organisations. There are functions that all those organisations do, so they'll have to face the question of what to do with those functions if they get into power, and whether they'll save enough, considering the kind of level of cuts that are being talked about across the public service.
This data today, Polly, it's the first time we've really been aware of the extent of the funding shortfall now facing schools.
That's right, and a lot of the focus has been on the surpluses in the budget, and this really shows that there are schools struggling even now, and the fact that it comes now when we're talking about wider funding cuts is an important kind of stocktake for government to consider that actually some schools are already struggling.
Polly Curtis. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the relics of a French saint who died more than 100 years ago begin a tour of the British Isles.
She'll travel on from here to Plymouth and then around the rest of the country before she goes back over to France.
But first, China's emissions are unlikely to fall to the levels recommended by the G8 and the European Union. That's the prognosis of an influential report by advisers to the Chinese government. In Beijing is our Asia Environment correspondent, Jonathan Watts.
This new paper plots out the possible courses that China could take to what it calls a low-carbon economy by 2050, which is, in one sense, something of a breakthrough. A year ago, there was nothing like this level of detailed discussion on where China should be going with regard to renewables and reducing carbon emissions. What it essentially says is, in a business-as-usual situation, China will be emitting a staggering amount of carbon by 2050. That's totally unsustainable, both for China and the world. So there has to be some alternative. And it gives these three different alternatives. In the best case scenario, it says by 2030, China's emissions should peak, and then it should sort of gradually come down from there. That is the best case. There are two other scenarios that see the peaking later on. The problem with all of them from perspective of climate change is that even the best case scenario would not be enough to prevent a more than 2 degrees Celsius rise in global temperatures by 2050. Now, of course, China's not the only country that will decide that, but as the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, its policy decisions will be extremely important in determining whether the world can avoid dangerous levels of global warming.
What can we glean about the direction that the Chinese government might take from this report?
Somewhat difficult to say. This report was released by an extremely influential group of institutions, including one of the government's own top think tanks on energy. So its policy recommendations and the chart it maps out will definitely be considered by the government. But it's much too early yet to say the government will do this because of this. It's just adding to the debate at a very, very high level and in much more detail than we've had until now.
There does seem to be a sort of hardening of the position of China when it comes to a global deal on climate change.
I think there's something of a hardening across the board at the moment, with a fairly short amount of time left until the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. Tensions are getting a little bit greater. People are sort of buckling down with their negotiating positions. I think everyone knows they're going to have to give some ground later on. But this is the stage where, no, I'm not going to give any ground. And China is no different in that regard and has been setting out a fairly tough stall and not unreasonably saying richer countries have been historically more responsible for carbon emissions. Richer countries, in terms of individuals, are still consuming a lot more carbon emissions. So it's up to rich countries really to lead the way. But of course, nothing will be a success without China. It's far too big a country. It's growing too quickly. And so I think there will be some ground given. Whether it's enough is a completely different matter. We might get a hint of where China is going next week when President Hu Jintao goes to a summit convened by the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to try and break through this logjam, this hardening of positions, and get the ball rolling in the final run into Copenhagen.
Jonathan Watts. The relics of Saint Therese, a Carmelite nun known as the Little Flower, are touring the British Isles. Thousands of Roman Catholics are expected to flock to see them, as Stephen Morris reports from the first venue on the tour, Portsmouth Cathedral.
My name is Canon John Udris. I'm the Dean of Northampton Cathedral and on the organising committee for the visit of the relics.
So why is this such a big event?
This is part of Therese's dream. Therese, the one whose relics we're welcoming this morning, had a dream about a year before she died. And in that dream she said, I would like to travel the earth preaching the gospel. I would like to be a missionary on all five continents and to the remotest isles. I would like to be a missionary to the ends of the earth.
So what sort of people do you expect to come along? Is it very religious Catholic people, or is it all sorts of people that are going to come?
We've tried to make it clear that the visit is open to everyone and anyone in the lead up to the visit. So Catholics certainly, I hope, will come in great numbers, but it's open to people of any faith and indeed of no faith. I'm sure there will be lots of people who are curious as to what's going on and who will be attracted to come, and perhaps even themselves not know quite why they're coming. And I think it's an opportunity for people to touch, literally, to touch the holy and to, in that way, experience a hunger for the spiritual that I think we see in our society today.
My name is Norman Price. It's lovely to see all the children here to celebrate Therese coming over here. And this being the first cathedral church in England that she's come to, she'll travel on from here to Plymouth and then around the rest of the country. She's over here for roughly 1 month before she goes back over to France.
My name is Helen Goodwin.
And so when the relics arrived?
And when I saw the big black car coming along, I started to feel very emotional. By the time the remains were brought through the door, I was actually crying, so I walked away. That is what it meant to me. And I just can't believe she's... I'm going to start again now, so you better cut off. Yeah, I was very emotional about it.
What does she mean to you, if you can put it into words?
When I was little, living back in Ireland, born and bred in Ireland, and my grandparents had the picture of St. Therese, and I always look up at that, and we used to get on our knees. When I stayed with my grandparents for a few years, because we all did eventually, we were made to say the rosary and then St. Therese and pray to her. And so that's as far back as it goes for me.
So she's always meant something
she's
to
always
you.
Been. And we went to Lisieux, is it Lisieux? We saw the casket there, but not like we've seen it here. It was like a smaller size, I think, but behind glass as well. So that's, we could just kneel down at the altar and say, oh, this is something else. This is my dream come true.
Stephen Morris reporting. Ian Chambers and Tim Mabey with the producers of today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.